Hello and welcome to 4Panel. We are the Geek Show. That sounded weird. That sounded weird when I said that. I don't like that.
What, you don't want to welcome them?
I don't know. It sounded very 70s American infomercial to me.
Hi! Welcome to 4Panel.
At least it wasn't...
I'm your host, Barry Scott.
At least it wasn't 1940s public service announcement.
4Panel, the podcast that scares grime out right away.
But whatever, that'll do. We're in the show now. Hi, everyone. I'm Andrew. That's Nick and Rob. I forgot Mick's name for a sec there as well.
It's all right. I forget my name regularly.
I was going to call you Graham, but you're not.
No.
That's a completely different podcast.
Yes, it is.
Although you very rarely see us in the same room, if ever.
Except for all the Saturdays when we meet up.
We use mirrors.
My God, it all makes sense now. Except for the many things about that that don't make any sense.
If we were here to make sense, we wouldn't be the podcast that we are.
This is true. Do you know what else doesn't make sense?
How long have you got?
Is it something that will, like, haphazardly get us to the news?
Yep. I was going to say, the other thing...
Oh, my God.
The other thing that doesn't make sense is the trailer for New Mutants. I honestly did not expect... I knew it was going to be some kind of horror thing, because we talked about that before. But I honestly didn't expect a trailer quite like that.
No. I thought I was watching the trailer for Saw 74.
Yeah.
Don't be silly, Mick. They're only up to eight Saw films.
No, 9 soon, isn't it?
No, yeah. No. This is the 8th. There's not already 8 Saw films. There can't be.
Is the new one called Jigsaw? Is that Saw 8 or 9 then?
Yeah, it's that. They're trying to pull that Tomb Raider. If we don't put a number on it, people won't realize that this franchise should have died decades ago.
Ah. Okay. So, what did you guys think of the New Mutants trailer?
I thought, well, this doesn't look like a New Mutants thing.
Yeah, it's weird. It's kind of like all the mutant kids just in a spooky, haunted asylum.
I'll tell you how effective it was as a trailer for me. The only good thing I've got to say about it, really, is I quite liked the use of the Pink Floyd soundtrack.
Oh, no, Mick. Don't say that.
It's like... It's like one of the most overused soundtracks in movies when you have kids involved.
I know.
Well, it's not even that. It's yet another trailer with, look how serious we are. We've taken a popular song and slowed it down.
Well, at least they didn't go for the whole...
They said it was a good thing within the context of that trailer.
At least they didn't go for the whole hog and basically slow it down and have it sung by Lord or Lordy or whatever her name is. I still don't know how to pronounce her name. Is it Lord or Lordy?
I'm surprised they haven't. I'm pretty sure it's just Lord. I think it's a silent E.
But Lord of what?
I wish I could care.
Yeah, it's weird, because, like, if you didn't know it was an X-Men thing,
yeah,
you wouldn't know it's an X-Men thing. Because there's, like, no talk of mutants. No, I mean, the closest you see to someone using their powers is someone is in a washing machine and they're on fire.
Yeah.
So that's
maybe
Sunspot?
Possibly.
Could be poltergeist activity. Within the context of the trailer, it could just be, oh, there's something weird in this house.
Yeah.
The title card could have just read from any sort of haunted stroke stalker house movie of the last sort of 30 years.
Maybe that sounds to me like an amazing title card. Just basically have that trailer and then a generic haunted house movie.
Yes.
Yes, but they already did that. It's called Cabin in the Woods.
Yeah. Well, Cabin in the Woods wasn't really generic, was it?
Yeah, but the joke was that it was set up like a generic haunted house movie.
True, true, true.
This just is a generic haunted house movie.
Yeah. The last thing we want is yet another scary movie.
And I think the depressing aspect of the New Mutants trailer is the news that it's also intended to be the start of a trilogy.
Yeah, they're introducing new characters with the next ones. Was it Warlock and Karma are going to be introduced? So that should be fun.
It's almost like the team at Fox have said, hey, we did really well with Fox and Logan. That's a bit non-standard. We better get back to doing what we do best.
Well, I spent the entirety of the trailer trying to name the mutants and failing.
Well, you've got the blonde one.
Yeah.
The blonde girl. That's magic. You've got Arya Stark, who is Wolfbane.
Yep.
Got Sunspot.
In a washing machine.
Yep. Also, looking up, I realised he's actually kind of white.
Yeah, he is. I have to wonder about what sort of washing machine is powerful enough to actually keep Sunspot inside.
Well, perhaps it's not. I mean, maybe he got put in there unconscious, and the clip you see in the trailer is the point at which he wakes up and goes, "Crap, I'm stuck in a washing machine. We'll see about that."
Either that or he crawled in by himself.
No, I only put it on for light rinse.
It's either that or he was looking for his comfortable place to sleep.
Not the spin cycle.
Sunspot's washing machine habit.
Danny Moonstar's in it as well, isn't she? She's the Native American girl.
Yeah.
Because I'm saying all these superhero names. What they are is blonde girl what you recognise off Game of Thrones, pale Brazilian man. A Native American girl.
I love the pale Brazilian man because if you've ever been there, you know they're not.
But I mean, you know, and I know that to a large extent comic book movies tend to be formulaic and horror genre movies tend to be formulaic, but this literally reads like someone has gone into that casting and gone, right, I've got a sheet of paper here with some boxes on. Have we got a blonde girl? Tick. Have we got a Native American girl? Tick.
So are you saying...
Have we got a doctor who's working with people but is clearly out of her depth? Tick.
Are you saying they casted it as if they were putting together a Benetton ad?
I've got a feeling that this screenplay came with casting instructions of an IKEA style.
Oh my God. Casting with a checklist, Andrew. It has a checklist.
Do you think that's what it is? This was actually just like a script for a generic horror film. And someone just like scribbled out the character names and just wrote X-Men character.
No, I know what it is. You remember the old Top Trumps card games where you used to get that card that had the tick boxes for all the other sets of Top Trump cards?
Yeah.
That's what this came with. It is
a checklist.
Basically, the screenplay was put down. It's a cookie cutter horror screenplay, and the cast list is just that card out of a set of New Mutants Top Trumps.
See, I can never resist checklists now since the diagram prize for hottest book title had one of the prize winners with a checklist.
I think that's what Rob wants, is just the movie to start, and it's just a picture of a checklist.
Yes,
and it's that for 2 hours.
I'd be happy.
With Aronofsky to direct.
No, not Aronofsky. I heard all about Mother. Oh, Mother? Yeah,
exactly, because then you'd get at the end of the film Aronofsky talking about like the metaphorical significance of the checklist. It's about life, man, and how we keep trying to put things in boxes and just check them off on a checklist. And that's Darren Aronofsky's The New Mutants.
Coming to a cinema near you.
Yeah. Moving on from that to Cable. Not Vince Cable, but Cable as in the other. Is he still... I have to check this. Is he still the son of Scott and Jean? Is he still Nathan Summers, or is he someone completely different now? I get confused.
I don't know, but I thought for a minute you were going to end that sentence with, I'm talking about Cable, not Vince Cable. The other superhero. At which point I was going to insist you take your medication before we go any further.
I'm confused now.
That's good, because we're talking about Cable.
Yes.
Yeah.
So, is he still the son of Scott and Jean?
Because that's the thing, I am quite curious how they're going to handle that in the film.
Yeah.
Like, is it just going to be completely glossed over? Or is there going to be, like, just a bit where Ryan Reynolds turns to camera and makes some kind of joke about it? I mean, I'm guessing the second one.
Yeah.
Probably. But, Cable is planned to have 4 films featuring him in some role.
Yeah, but is this going to be one of those situations? Because didn't they say something about something similar with Wonder Woman signing up for 3 movies, but 2 of them were ensemble pieces?
Oh, what if Cable is the big bad in New Mutants?
Would there not possibly have been a hint of that in the trailer?
Well, no, because I'm just remembering they did that old crossover event for X-Men called Executioner's Song, where was it Cable? It wasn't Cable. It was one of his alternate versions called Strife. Do you remember that one, Andrew?
I'm like vaguely aware of who Strife is, but no.
Okay. Well.
Also, I feel like they're not going to throw Cable in a film before Deadpool 2.
No. Yeah, true. New Mutants.
What I'm guessing probably Deadpool 2, then the X-Force film, maybe.
Oh, he's got to be in the X-Force film. He was one of the founding members, wasn't he?
Yeah, and then what I was going to say is like maybe he'll be in New Mutants 2, because the original X-Force was what happened when Cable took over the New Mutants, and were like, what if we just killed people now? That'd be fun.
Yeah, that sounds like a Cable move.
And then a fourth film.
Cable and Deadpool? That was a big thing for a while.
Maybe some kind of like Deadpool 3 or an X-Men. Oh, heck, even a Cable film. Who knows?
Well, Cable and Deadpool was a very popular thing for a while, wasn't it? As in the two of them in their own comic.
Yeah, but that was a long time ago now. That was like late 2000s.
It's still an option for a later film, though. Possibly.
Possibly. But then the question is, would that be another Cable film, or would that be Deadpool 3, effectively?
I think it'd be Deadpool 3, effectively.
They're not going to do what they did with Batman, are they? and give each film a title that would be more suitable to the one before it.
Is this going to be Cable versus Deadpool? Dawn of Justice?
Surely isn't that only for like one of the Batman films, though?
Oh, don't spoil it with your facts.
I mean, you can't really call the last one Batman Begins.
I was talking more about the Joel Schumacher.
Batman. Because they continued that. They didn't really number them. They went Batman and Robin, then they went to Batman Begins, then The Dark Knight, then The Dark Knight Rises.
Yeah, but I was thinking more from the point of view that Batman and Robin was a better title for the film before it.
Yeah, should have been the one when they actually had Robin.
Yeah. Whereas Batman Forever was a rubbish title.
True.
You're right. And that was literally the only thing wrong with those two films.
Absolutely. if they'd have just fixed those titles, everything else would have been dandy.
Really?
No.
Yep, suddenly the bat nipples and the bat credit cards would have made
no, them. No, because I got the entire anthology a few years ago cheap on Blu-ray, and this weekend I actually got round to watching them, and oh my word, the quality suddenly drops after Batman Returns, doesn't it?
So
I'm worried for you, Mick, sometimes. You're watching Batman and Robin and Batman Forever, you're collecting all the Civil War 2. There's better things to do with your time, Mick.
You have a life, Mick. You have a life. Don't do it. Don't do it.
So much good in the world.
I don't have a life. That's the point.
It's all right, Mick. It's all right. You just come down off that ledge. It's okay.
Look, I did it to try and decide whether there was a worse DC movie than Suicide Squad.
Oh, God, yes.
And now I know that there isn't.
Oh, he's pushing me to... You don't want to watch the Justice League-type movie from the 90s.
Yeah, but was it actually...
The failed TV pilot.
Yes.
I'm talking about theatrical released movies.
Oh.
I'm not talking about failed TV pilots. Because we'd be here all night.
True. Oh, anyway. What do you guys think of a Cable 4 movie thing?
Well, it depends whether they do a Deadpool with it or whether they do a New Mutants with it.
It's also kind of hard to say, like, when all we have of Cable is two pictures.
Yeah. True. Although,
Shall we reserve judgment until after Deadpool 2's released?
Yeah, let's reserve judgment. Although, I have to say, I would be interested in seeing a Cable-Deadpool movie, kind of like a road movie, a bit like Fear and Loathing in Las Vegas.
I mean, you are going to see a Cable and Deadpool movie.
Yeah, but not the Cable and Deadpool movie that is in my head at the moment.
How do you know? For all you know, that's exactly what's happening.
If that's exactly what's happening.
How do you know they didn't kidnap you while you slept one night and took the idea of that movie out of your head?
Because this is not Dark City, I hope. I'm actually looking round when I say that. Anyway, moving on. Marvel conventions.
Yay, moving from Marvel to Marvel.
Yes.
Yeah. So Marvel obviously gets featured as something of an A-lister when it comes to comic book conventions. And they're up front and centre when Disney hold their D23 Expos. But they're talking now about the possibility of doing their own Marvel-focused Expo event. And it's not uncharted territory for Marvel. They did it before in 1975.
The year I was born.
Which is probably why they never did it again.
Yeah, true. It's my fault then.
1975, they hosted their own comic book convention, the originally titled MarvelCon, which, of course, most people now just use to apply to any kind of crossover event. But it is most memorably in the annals of history where Stan Lee announced Jack Kirby's return to the publisher after a 5-year stint at DC.
I want to know who comes up with these names. I want their job because MarvelCon is not really, it's not really a name that you have to think hard about. It's like the title of the new Star Wars movie, the Han Solo movie. You know, the untitled one that's suddenly called Solo, a Star Wars story.
Yeah.
I hate to burst your bubble, Rob.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's like some specific job to sit there and just say, what if for this convention we just took the name of the publisher and slapped Con on the end? And that's it. That's the entire day's work.
You've never worked in marketing, have you?
For some people, that is their day job.
Yeah, I know.
What the hell am I doing a podcast for? You losers can do this by yourself. I'm going into marketing.
It's a very specific skill to chop words up and then stick them together to make new words that sound exciting.
Yes.
It's one of the specific skill sets that Liam Neeson mentions in the movies Taken, but those scenes where he uses it are cut out.
See, the only reason I know that there are people whose job that is because I used to be one of them.
Sure, it's not just that that's all you would do for your job, and so you got fired.
No, that was literally my job, or one of my jobs anyway.
I glide past in the morning on a skateboard and say, hi guys, can't stop, MarvelCon.
See?
And it's people like in that kind of job that come along and say clever things like, so you think you're looking for a title for this movie about an invasion of sharks caused by a tornado. Let's call it Sharknado.
Yep.
Now, that came after months of meetings where they tossed around ideas like Tor Shark.
Shark Wind.
Or
Spinny Fish.
Or Killer Storm. Those kind of things.
See, Andrew references the skateboard, but the thing that made me laugh when he said that was I was actually working in marketing during the 90s when skateboarding was, you know, that craze was at its height. So, yes, there were people I worked with coming to work on skateboards.
See, but now I'm extra suspicious because I've heard Rob's 90s stories and I'm now pretty sure this entire thing was just a hallucination he had.
Nope.
No,
Rob, you never worked in marketing. You were just home. In your underpants.
Nope.
No, it was the 90s. He worked in marketing. He was allowed to go to the office on his skateboard in his underpants.
Again, no. Anyway, meanwhile, MarvelCon, yeah.
Yeah, so Kevin Feige said that there have been discussions for this kind of event. And they're trying to build on the successes they've had at San Diego and also looking at the success they've had with Star Wars celebrations and stuff like that. So the idea of doing something like that focused around Marvel content and Marvel fans.
My first question about that is, are they going to do Dancing Avengers?
We don't know. We literally know that there have been discussions.
Okay.
Some of those discussions may or may not have included, are they going to be dancing, whatever.
Because the last thing we need in the world is Hulk doing the tango or something like that. Or
see, now you've said it.
Yeah.
It could happen.
Or Hulk doing like flamenco, you know, Spanish flamenco.
I've just read a comic strip where someone was making a movie of Judge Dredd's career and there's a Bollywood scene in it.
What?
featuring Judge Death.
What?
You heard?
Judge Death in Bollywood.
Yes.
So, Andrew, your thoughts on Judge Death in Bollywood?
Yes.
maybe that's how they should make any follow-up to the Carl Urban Dread movie.
Can it work in Bollywood? See, at this point, I'm saying, screw MarvelCon. I want to know more about Judge Death in Bollywood. How did this come about?
Judge Death do a head wobble. Surely if he tries, his like, crusty, decaying neck just going to snap off.
I don't know.
Well, if you think about it, it's just a sort of controlled version of that thing when he takes over a new host, isn't it?
Yeah, this is true. I need to find out more about this.
You want actually, me to...
That raises an even bigger question. Is it Judge Death in a Bollywood scene? Of a Bollywood scene in which everyone is Judge Death?
Oh, no. No, 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 no.
In this, Judge Death is in a Bollywood scene.
I was going to say, I started panicking if everyone in a Bollywood scene was Judge Death.
I mean, back to what the story is actually about. Yeah. sure, Marvel, you go ahead. You have a convention.
Yeah.
I mean, it's going to be in America, which is where none of us live.
Yep.
So it literally has no impact on my life.
Unless, of course, they tie it in with one of their more international concerns, like their theme park in Dubai or somewhere like that.
Which is, again, a place where we don't live.
Dubai is another country in which I do not live.
That's true.
Although,
I'm just saying they won't necessarily do it in the US.
A little aside, we recorded the Geek Show, and one of the news articles was talking about the Dubai police force and how they're going to get these hover bikes, which hover at about 16 feet, and they look remarkably dangerous and only have a 25-minute charge.
Oh, they're brilliant, the Dubai police force. Because the roads of Dubai are filled with, like, top-end cars.
Yeah.
Quite a lot of them supercars and hypercars. They've got, like, P1s as police cars.
What?
Yeah.
I mean, they're not going to get much done in a Vauxhall Astra, are they?
This is true.
The best they could do if they had a Vauxhall Astra is just park up and wait for the villains to come back. But yeah, they have wild cars on the police force in Dubai.
Oh wow. Okay, well, they're soon to get hover bikes as well. So
excellent. If any police force was going to get them, I would expect it would be them.
Final news story. The guy who wrote Seven, the movie Seven, Andrew Kevin Walker, has been hired to write a new live-action adaptation of Kazuya Koike and Gosuke Kojima's classic manga, Lone Wolf and Cub. Now, it's had live-action adaptations in the past, which were made by, you know, Japanese filmmakers in Japan. And they're all right, but they've got a cult following. But this looks to be a modern remake. And, it's got me interested. If it's got the guy who wrote Seven, then I'm hoping, because Seven is a cracking movie.
It is.
When you say modern remake, do you mean just made, like, today? Or it's going to be set in a modern-day setting?
No, I don't know at the moment, because it's got the guy who's directing... it's got Justin Lin, the director of Star Trek Beyond, who is going to be producing the film, and he initially signed up to direct it in 2012, so he's been invested for like 5 years, so he really wants to do it, obviously. And so I don't know if it's going to have a translation into the modern era, or whether they're actually going to set it in the era it's set in, because...
Yeah, it's set in feudal Japan, isn't it?
Yeah, it's Lone Wolf and Cub. You can't really set it in the modern era because, hell, he's going around with a baby in a pushcart and, you know, he's raising the baby to be just as psycho as he is.
But see, now I want Lone Wolf and Cub, only it's set in the modern day and Cub is in a papoose.
Well, there are scenes where Cub is in a papoose in the manga.
Okay, and then back to it being in feudal Japan then.
Cool.
Either way, as long as we acknowledge that the most important part of this film is the papoose.
Not
and
the pushcart.
The papoose is very fun to say.
So, not the pushcart.
I mean, pushcart isn't as fun to say. Pushcart. It's no papoose.
No, because in some of the movies, the pushcart, you know, the baby in the pushcart is just as badass as the samurai himself, because the pushcart is tricked out like the Batmobile. It's got like swords in the handles that shoot out and stab people in the stomach and various things.
Right,
like that.
In case it wasn't clear for me saying the word papoose a lot,
yes,
I don't know much about Lone Wolf and Cub.
Lone Wolf and Cub. Yeah, I think it's a. If it's set in feudal Japan and they don't do a bloody Last Samurai deal on it, then I'm fine.
What if, like, it's 100% an amazing adaptation, but then in the last 5 minutes, Tom Cruise appears and throws a samurai sword at someone?
Then I will have to find the guys who made the film and punch them in the balls.
Oh. But Rob, you forgot the lesson of the film, that Tom Cruise is a better samurai than anyone from Japan.
Yeah, but it's the same lesson that you have in, like, Brotherhood of the Wolf, where the white Frenchman is a better Native American than the Native American.
I think you mean Kevin Costner in Dances with Wolves.
Oh, no, Brotherhood of the Wolf is the same.
Of course, there are multiple films about how the best Native Americans are white people.
Yes.
Although, then again, I say that, I guess we had a whole genre of films where the best black people are white people with, like, mud smeared on their faces.
Not going there. We're not going there. Let's take
Olden
a break.
Olden days were racist, Rob.
Yes, I know. Let's take a break on that note.
Well, I may be hungry, but there's always time for The Geek Show.
The Geek Show is the largest independent podcast network out there. And to be independent, we need a little bit of help every now and again. So if you want something to show your love of The Geek Show, head over to thegeekshow.co.uk, click on the shop, and buy some of our lovely wares.
This is voice actor Bryce Papenbrook, and you're listening to the Geek Show Podcast Network.
Welcome back to 4Panel. And now, the bit you've all been looking forward to, the review section.
Yes.
And we're starting with, I've forgotten already, Rob.
Yes. 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 I've been chomping at the bit. I've got an interesting one to start off with called Trent, the Dead Man. And I was a bit surprised when I started reading this, because I thought the cover is basically a guy walking through the snow with snowshoes on, and he's got a dog. And I didn't notice this, but his trousers have like a yellow line down the side. I thought, oh, right, looks a bit like a Mountie. Turns out he is. He's a guy called Philip Trent, and he's basically wandering. This starts off with him wandering through a snowfield in a blizzard, looking for a place to find shelter with his trusty dog. And it's essentially a mystery type thing, just a straightforward mystery set in Canada during like the Gold Rush era.
Straightforward because there's been no crime because Canada's too lovely.
Well, no, there has been crime, but it's I'm a bit confused as to what's actually going on with Trent's past. I mean, this originally came out in 1991, and you know, it's out now from Cinebook, and I was basically thinking, I'm not sure what's going on, because Trent is referring to, he's having these dreams about his past and thinking, okay, so what happened in his past? And he ends up helping this girl called Agnes, this young woman, who appears in the middle of the snow, fighting off some wolves, and gives her shelter. Turns out she's looking for her brother, and Trent, ironically enough, is actually on the hunt for her brother as well, because her brother is wanted for questioning about various crimes. So the two of them meet, and the story continues from there. And this is kind of your very typical early 90s European comic, I have to say. It's very well drawn, it's very well coloured, the artwork is really, really nice, but the story is kind of a nothing, you know? Aside from Trent being lonely and wanting a wife after his first wife kind of abandoned him or something like that, which you never get to find out what actually happened, and aside from him being friendly with the Inuits and the Native Americans, that's pretty much it. There's not much there except the mystery, and the mystery is pretty easily solved. I was expecting more, you know, when it says Trent in big letters on the cover, the Dead Man, I was expecting more, but it's not really that great, I'll be honest. So, that was Trent, created by Leo and Rudolph, the team behind Kenya. So,
see, now I like the idea that Leo and Rudolph just couldn't think of a title for it. And eventually just went, there's a dead man in it. We'll just call it The Dead Man.
Yeah. I mean, it's a series about a Mountie, and I've got to say, I've never read a comic book series about a Mountie. So.
I've never read a comic book series.
What are you doing on this show?
I there's not much more I can say about Trent. It's a really nice looking bit of nothing, very light on substance. So yeah, over to you, Andrew.
Yep. So I have quite another quick series. This is Flying Witch by Chihiro Ishizuka. I'm getting better at the Japanese names.
Yes.
So this is a manga series we've got sent, and it is about a girl called Makoto, who is a witch, and she basically moved to the Japanese countryside. They kind of moved in with the cousins, and she's going to learn how to do some magic. And okay. It's just one of those nice series.
So I've got to ask just one quick question. Does she actually fly then? Because they called it Flying Witch.
Yep, that is like one of the first things she does is she goes out and buys a broomstick. And it's actually quite fun because she's with her younger cousin who's got absolutely no idea she's a witch.
Ah.
And just like sees her hovering off the ground and gets a very, like, it's kind of one of those blank, I'm just not going to deal with this right now expressions.
Okay.
But then also, like, she gives her a lift home on the broomstick. And then you just, like, see her in the background of the rest of that chapter. It's like running around with her arms stretched out like an aeroplane.
Okay, that's kind of cute.
So yeah, this is just, you know, it's a very cute little comedy series. And it's just, it's a nice thing to read. It's sort of like a palate cleanser.
All right.
Just something where, you know, there's no real stakes, no real drama. Like, she doesn't have to be a scary evil monster to save the world. It's just some nice fun things happen.
You know what it sounds like, the way you describe it? It sounds a bit like, you remember that that Ghibli movie, the one about the witch?
Kiki's Delivery Service.
Yeah, it sounds a bit like that.
I think it does have kind of that Studio Ghibli, everything is fine and happy, don't worry about anything kind of vibe.
Yeah, and a witch going by herself somewhere to learn magic and stuff like that and learn how to be a proper witch, I'm assuming.
Kind of like that. But okay. It more focuses on just kind of her hanging out with her friends and family.
All right, okay.
Because like, she makes friends with a girl at school called Nao, and she decides to give her a token of friendship. And basically, like, they're walking home past a forest, and she says, "Ooh, just wait here a sec, I'm going to get you a special plant." And she comes back, and it's a mandrake root. Nice. And she's just like holding out this screaming plant going, "Here, it's for you." And I was like, "No, thanks."
See, that's fun. I like that. You know when you said she's got a friend called Now? I don't know why, but my brain went to League of Gentlemen. "You're my friend now."
Oh, that's not sweet and fun like this manga is. But I think possibly my favourite character is Kay, who is Makoto's older cousin. And like, he's such a troll. Because basically when he's introducing Makoto to his sister, Chinatsu, basically like, Chinatsu says, "Oh, who's this?" Because she says, "This is your real mother." Like, Chinatsu just like jumps up and hugs and yells, "Mummy!" Like, there's another bit where basically he's about to go out and hang out with his friends, and Makoto's like, "Oh, can I come with you?" She's like, "No. No, because you would lose all respect for me."
Okay. This sounds like a lot of fun, actually.
Yeah. Also, I like that what it manages to do is kind of where quite a few comedy manga fall down, is it's done quite a good job of translating it for an international audience.
All right.
Because her uncle, who kind of runs the house, one of the jokes is he has a really thick rural accent. And they've actually managed to translate that from Japanese to, like, to a full-on country bumpkin.
Really? He sounds like a yokel.
He's got lines like, "Out of back of the hay house, there's a little bit of feel. You go head in and use that." Like, They basically like transcribed a Somerset accent. It's great.
Oh, how do you transcribe a Somerset accent?
With difficulty.
Well, read Flying Witch to find out. Boom! There's the sales pitch.
Oh, this sounds like a lot of fun, actually.
It is. It's just, it's the kind of thing you read with just like a big smile across your face.
Excellent. Oh, I shall have to read that. I haven't read that one.
Me now, isn't it?
Yes, it is.
It is you.
Oh. Right, so I'll kick off with Man-Thing. And this is the 5-issue limited series now collected in a trade paperback, written by R.L. Stein.
Off of the Goosebumps.
Off of the Goosebumps. So I suspect his work, where the blurb claims him to be a beloved writer, I suspect he's a beloved writer of a generation younger than me.
That's most definitely. But also I should point out that Mick's just quite bitter about this, because his Man-Thing is only regular size.
It's not giant size.
Excuse me, I think you'll find that contractually it's my job to lower the tone.
We're not lowering the tone.
That was no tone to lower.
We're speaking factual things. Man-size used to be released in a comic that was giant-sized. It actually said it on the cover.
It isn't giant-sized.
No, not the one that you've got, but it used to be. In the olden days, Man-Thing was giant-sized.
I was happily just making thinly veiled innuendos while sitting here in a gutter.
Yes.
You see, and at least yours sounded like that, Andrew. At least you didn't feel the need to try and justify what you were saying.
Thank you, Mick. Please tell us about your tiny man thing.
With pleasure. So, now, I'm not familiar with Goosebumps. I understand it was quite a popular TV show and then subsequently released as a movie. But I'm not familiar with...
Based on a series of books.
All right. I don't know who R.L. Stein is. Like I say, I believe he's aimed at a younger generation. So that could be just about any other generation, really.
It was basically like Tales from the Crypt of the 90s.
Yeah. And in the introduction to the collected Man-Thing, he kind of goes on about how he grew up reading comics of the Vault of Horrors, Tales from the Crypt type, and that he came across Man-Thing when he was at college and had always wanted to write for Man-Thing. And he got the opportunity to do so and seized it with both hands. And I think that's... There'll now be a brief pause while Rob collects himself.
You did that on purpose.
No, I didn't.
Rob, should we just mute ourselves for this bit? Because I think it's the only way we're going to get through.
Yeah. Oh, go on. It's right.
And therein lies the problem. I think he's wanted to write Man-Thing for so long that what you've got is 5 issues where he throws every Man-Thing idea he's had over those years into one storyline.
So it's Sucker Punch.
Yeah, basically. Although it holds together a lot better than Sucker Punch, it has to be said. But if you're a casual reader who isn't familiar with Man-Thing's history, you get a kind of one-page Brody's Notes version of, like, Man-Thing's origin, the fact that he's struggled to regain his ability to speak, and stuff like that. You get a sort of one-page overview of all that, and then it's straight into a story that's related directly to that.
So, Ian, would these people who are casuals about Man-Thing, would they be casual Man-Things or Man-Thing casuals?
There'd be occasional readers, Rob, and well, you know it. There may be people...
You just want to force the joke now, Rob.
Yes.
About this series, you should never try and force a man thing.
So, desperately trying to get back on point.
Because that's how you get kicked out of Hollywood.
Oh, topical joke.
And not only that, but strangely relevant, because that's exactly what happens to Man Thing at the opening. He gets kicked out of Hollywood, where he's been working in a string of sort of creature feature B-movies. But as a result of the reactions to test audiences, they've decided to axe the series and he's out on the streets and returns to his swamp. However, things are not well in the swamp. There are giant crocodiles that weren't there before. There's pythons mysteriously appearing of giant size. And they just happen, coincidentally, on the day that Man-Thing returns to his swamp, they just happen to be taking his former love from when he was a human captive. And Man-Thing realizes that things aren't right. And this is where the Man-Thing fan may well be perfectly all right with this. He may know, he or she may know the relevance of the old father in Man-Thing Swamp. But if you're a casual reader, again, you get a one-page overview of who this all-powerful character is. Then you get flung into the nexus of all realities and travel to a parallel world. And for the thickness of the comic, we're talking about a 5-issue run here. It throws a lot of concepts at you. It's like a Jodorowsky light. There's a lot of concept in there. It does hold together as a story, but it's unsatisfying because it skates over the surface detail, rather than potentially, having some really in-depth storyline. So it feels more like a treatment than a full-fledged comic. I mean, it's beautifully drawn. The art's by Daniel Warren Johnson and German Peralta, but you find yourself wanting more, even though you've got a complete story.
Okay.
It's got a backup feature of a couple of short stories from R.L. Stine's own sort of archives. And they're really good. They're only 3 or 4 pages long, but have more depth than most of the whole Man-Thing series that's collected beforehand.
Yeah, because I guess those are just self-contained stories, aren't they?
Yeah, but they're ultimately more satisfying than the 70 or so pages that precede them. So it was a bit disappointing. I think Man-Thing is one of those comic books that I was aware of existing, but had never really sort of read it. And I've sort of seen the character when he's crossed over into other Marvel titles. But this series wouldn't hook me enough to go out and buy more Man-Thing comics.
And I guess the problem is he's kind of too weird of a character for this kind of, just roll with it style of storytelling.
Yeah, I think that's it. It's the kind of character that you kind of need that background to understand him, to understand his motivations, to understand what his powers are, because they're revealed at the time he uses them. And then again, you get a sort of a couple of panels that sort of go, oh, and by the way, this is because this happened.
Basically, you need another 5-issue miniseries just to explain who the hell Man-Thing is.
Yeah, yeah.
Sounds about right, actually.
So yeah, enjoyable as far as it goes, but I wanted more, but not in a good way.
Okay.
I wanted more in issues 1 to 5 rather than wanting issues 6 to 10. If that makes sense.
It makes sense to me.
Yeah, it makes sense. It makes sense.
Good.
Anyway, moving away from Mick, who's unsatisfied by Man-Thing, to the Black...
Oh, dear. Lord. Right, next time we get stuff to review, I am not touching your Man-Thing, all right?
I think we've all proven that we're far too immature to ever have Man-Thing on the show again.
I have The Black Beetle, Kara Bocek. Now, this is a mystery tale by Francesco Francavilla, and I know this because it says it on the cover that it's a mystery tale by Francesco Francavilla.
That's handy.
Yeah, and it's out from Dark Horse in a rather lovely hardback version, and it starts off, first thing that you see when you open this is a map of a rough map of an area that includes Constantinople, and it's like a river area type thing. And then it goes on to the Black Beetle. Then you have this really nice 2-page spread of the Black Beetle swinging across the rooftops of Constantinople. And
but now it's Istanbul, not Constantinople.
Well, it actually starts off by talking about how Romantics still refer to it as Constantinople, even though the Turks changed the name to Istanbul.
Yeah, because that's the thing. Why did Constantinople get the works? That's nobody's business.
Yeah.
But the Turks.
Yeah. So, anyway, you start off with a Thomas Sawyer, who is on a riverboat heading to Constantinople, and he meets Fraulein Elsa Vogel on the boat, and Elsa is travelling as well, and the two of them meet, the two of them are talking to each other, they enjoy a pleasant time on the boat, and arrive in Istanbul, where Thomas is off to meet somebody, an old friend of his. But what he doesn't know is that Elsa is working for the Nazis, and Elsa is... she's got a spy in Istanbul who is helping them search for a thing that Thomas is also here for, and he has to meet his friend Aziz, and he was the only American on the boat, so obviously the Nazis know who to follow. And it's got a very kind of Indiana Jones-esque vibe for a good portion of this, and you begin to wonder after a certain point, why is it called the Black Beetle? When does the Black Beetle make it and, you know, show up in this? Because obviously, you know Thomas, you know Tom Sawyer, as we'll call him. You know he's the Black Beetle.
What?
It's kind of obvious right from the beginning. You know, he's the main character. The main character is going to be the Black Beetle. If it was somebody else as the Black Beetle, and they just suddenly turned up, and he was a bystander, I think I would have been more invested in this. But, you know he's the Black Beetle pretty much from the beginning. But it turns out the Black Beetle isn't anything other than kind of a super spy type person keeping rare and powerful relics of the past out of the hands of people who could do harm with them. And what he's come to collect from his friend Aziz is very interesting because it's a piece of what I'm assuming is alien technology. And we're not going to say what it is, but the Nazis are willing to hunt him down and kill him for it. So he's forced to use it and decides, I like this toy, I'm going to keep it. It's really, really well drawn, but it's got that, you know, that color palette that they sometimes use when they're setting something in kind of the Arab states, or the Arabic states. So everything has that yellow-orange tint to it. What do they call it in photography? I've forgotten the name.
Sepia.
Sepia, yeah. It's got that sepia.
That's what everyone was using the other day when the sun went red.
Yeah. It's got that sepia tint to it. But the great thing about this, because the story is just basically, it's a communal garden. Oh, guy goes against the Nazis for a relic. And I've seen that in Indiana Jones, you know, loads of times. And Indy didn't dress as a beetle with a cape and bug eyes and a red beetle type thing. But at the back of this, though, it's got some really nice posters that have been done as if the Black Beetle was, as if it was a movie. And these are really nice kind of pulp posters for a possible Black Beetle movie, along with some sketchwork for the actual, you know, the actual story. And then it says, next, the Black Beetle in Necrologue, written and directed by Francesco Francovia.
I like that. That's fun.
So it's very pulpy, and it's very fun in that pulpy way, but ultimately it's kind of lacking, again, with I think this might have been better if it was a bit of a longer story, you know, so they could add more intrigue, more kind of, you know, more of a mystery, more of a thriller element to it. But it's very much, he goes there, and then it goes from A to B in a very linear way, you know? But still, yeah. It really looks nice, and I love the art style for it. I think the art style is really, 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 really nice. And the cover does make it look great. A lot more interesting than it actually is, unfortunately.
You know, it's funny that you say that, because it seems like this week we've all got books that kind of fit to a similar theme.
Yeah.
Mm.
Because I was taking the ball and, like, running away with it.
That's fine. I was done.
Okay, good. I just wanted to make sure I wasn't, like, cutting you off before the big important point. But anyway, I also have a Marvel 5-issue miniseries. It's the Kingpin series they did, kind of collected into one trade paperback. Which, and also before I start talking about this, I need to tangent.
Okay.
Because kind of the name they've given this collected edition is Born Against.
Okay.
Like, I get it. It's, you know, it's like Born Again, the famous Daredevil story. But also what? That doesn't make sense. But Born Against what?
That's the question that I had when I saw the title for this.
Like, it's not a phase. This isn't some some clever wordplay you've employed. You've just taken the name of a story and changed one of the words. Something that sounds similar, but is completely nonsensical.
Yep.
Anyway, now that that bit of the rant is over, on to the, like, the book itself. And I appreciate what the writer Matthew Rosenberg has tried to do. Instead of, it's not like a standard superhero comic. It's more like some kind of Sopranos-esque drama that you'd see on TV.
Okay.
So it follows a reporter named Sarah Dewey as she gets sort of courted by the Kingpin because he wants her to write his autobiography now that he's decided he's going straight, and he kind of wants to prove that to the world. And I think it's an interesting setup, just not one that in any way works in a comic book. Because I feel like you can't really have a slow burn plot when what you've got is kind of a 22-page long issue. So what you end up with is basically three issues of Sarah saying, I don't know if I want to write the Kingpin's autobiography. And then the Kingpin says, no, you should. I'm a great guy. I'm really nice. But then someone else says, oh, no, you shouldn't write Kingpin's autobiography. He's a bad guy. And it's just kind of this constant back and forth for like three issues where the plot just doesn't really go anywhere. And also, like, the stuff the Kingpin does to appear like a nice guy is just ridiculously over the top. Like, there's literally a bit where he gives lollipops to orphans.
Okay, is he just trying to prove that he's a nice guy, or is he actually running for mayor?
It's funny you say that, because apparently, like, in an upcoming story of Daredevil, that's what he's doing.
Really?
Yeah.
Because that's a newer and original idea.
Marveling new and original ideas. Oh, Mick, you card.
I know.
Sorry, I'm just imagining Kingpin doing the whole kissing babies thing when the babies look like smaller versions of him.
It just looked like he was assembling an army.
Exactly. An army of mini-me.
And also he's desperately trying not to accidentally eat the baby.
Yes.
Leading to the much-wanted Kingpin Despicable Me crossover.
God.
But anyway, that's just the first three issues of this five-issue miniseries.
Only the first three?
Yeah.
I thought but we were then, done.
Oh, no. Now we're getting to the turn, because do you want to know a secret? This wasn't actually a five-issue miniseries.
What?
This was supposed to be much longer, but it got cancelled.
Wow.
Just like Marvel do with a lot of stuff. So then you get... just the last two issues are completely insane, because it's just this insane, like, rapid fire. Tombstone captures them, but then he doesn't, then his men get killed, and then Sarah finds out that some other guy's corrupt, and she does a story, and then, like, he exposes that guy, and he's taken down, and then also, like, she sleeps with some dude, but then also turns out the Kingpin planned everything all along. That's just... It's not a good plot, because it's literally every page is just, and then this happened, and then this happened, and then this happened. Oh god, we've only got like 10 pages left. Quick, more things have to happen so that we can actually end the series.
Do you know what that sounds like? Do you know when they have like the 7-year-old in class and they have to write about what they did over summer?
Yeah, it basically turns into that. But then it's really annoying because the ending is actually really good.
Okay.
Because like you've got this bit where basically the Kingpin reveals that everything he did was a facade. But at this point, like, Sarah can't really reveal anything because she's so deep in his pocket. Because like he's basically fixed all the problems in her life. It's like, yeah, you could publish this book, but I'll destroy your career and your kids will have to go back to your abusive ex-husband.
Wow.
That's just, that's the Kingpin series I want to read. Or like, he just manipulates and outsmarts everyone who comes against him. Not this Kingpin visits sick kids in hospital, like, gives their parents a hug, and then a grandma walks past him and goes, oh, it's Willy Fisk! Like, pinches his cheeks, all 19 of them.
Such a good boy. So good, I mean, to his mother.
That's basically what it is. And also, I know we don't usually talk about the art, but I kind of do want to talk about Ben Torres's art in this.
Okay.
Because again, it's another one of those things that's a really cool idea. Because he's basically drawn the whole thing in the style of Frank Miller, but kind of with the edges cleaned up. And you get like nice little nods, like when the Kingpin first appears. So he's wearing the white suit and he's in the same pose. It's like when he first appeared in the comics. And there's a bit where like Sarah's on the phone and there's a crash of lightning. And it all goes like black and white and looks exactly like something from Sin City.
Okay.
But for the most part, it's kind of problematic because it's, you get that problem when one artist is deliberately trying to do things in the style of another artist that everyone ends up looking kind of flat and a bit awkward.
Yeah.
Especially the art. Every character just looks like they have no idea what to do with their arms.
Does any character in comics ever know what to do with their arms?
I mean, I guess Rob Liefeld characters do because all they can do is like hang by the side because they're covered in child arm inflatable arm rings.
Well, not only that, it's not their arms that they're worried about. Their arms are well developed because they've got no legs or feet.
Yeah.
They've got points.
That's unless they just disappear off into the void.
Yes. my leg is infinite.
But yeah, that's Kingpin. It's annoying because it had a lot of potential, but I just feel like it's got a plot that should be wrapped up in like the first two issues and then being about the actual Kingpin doing Kingpin stuff.
Okay. So, final one for you, Mick.
That's easy for you, sir.
It's not.
So I got the complete hard-boiled second edition collection from Frank Miller. Eisner Award-winning hard-boiled, I'll have you know. First published in 1990, and this is the second edition of the collected edition.
Okay, I just want to clarify. This is the comic book hard-boiled, the graphic novel, I should say.
And that's right.
It's got nothing to do with the movie called Hard-Boiled that stars Chow Yun-Fat.
No.
Right, okay, I'm just clarifying.
It has nothing to do with Rocket Raccoon supporting character Hard-Boiled Henry.
No, it has nothing to do with either of those things, or indeed any other thing you may care to mention that has Hard-Boiled in its title.
Eggs?
The Frank Miller comic book series Hard-Boiled.
It has everything to do with that, Andrew, because that's what it is.
Okay.
Okay. And it's interesting that Andrew's review mentioned someone paying homage to Frank Miller's art because they've done a change to the art in this collection. The primary colours from the original that were quite sort of vibrant and bold and in your face have been somehow muted. It's the palette now is more akin to Moebius's work on Inkle.
All right, okay.
And in fact, it's as crazy a story as Inkle, and now the artwork matches it. So I felt like I was not reading a Frank Miller, apart from the fact that there was lots of blood, guts and gore and sex. It felt more like a sort of just more violent version of Inkle, really.
I tricked you.
Yeah. I kept looking to see if there was a dust jacket on it covering up the fact that it was actually another Jodorowsky. The story is intense, as you'd expect from Miller, and quite gratuitously violent and oversexed. The muted artwork doesn't really lend itself to it, and it you feel at some time, because it's so detailed, the artwork, because all the world building happens in the artwork. And there are some nice little nods, like they'll go past poster hoardings that have got recruitment messages featuring Martha Washington. Inciting people to join PACs.
Okay.
Which is quite a nice little nod. But the story is a sort of strange Blade Runner type, sort of Blade Runner, sort of Total Recall, Philip K. Dick nightmare.
Okay.
Imagine a Philip K. Dick story about a warmongering robot that had been filled with the consciousness of people, then that story is drawn and written by two people who've had crystal meth.
Okay, that's a bit confusing.
So all three of the people are on crystal meth?
Yes, but not together at the same time. So basically you've got a suburban insurance investigator who's on the trail of someone who's put a false claim in. And he's the kind of insurance investigator who treats those kind of people with extreme prejudice, let's say. You've got Nixon, who's a homicidal tax collector.
that sounds right, actually.
Yeah. And, of course, he's racking up a bit of a body count. And Unit 4 is the ultimate robot killing machine. And somehow, all three of those personalities are the same person. And that's what Hard-Boiled is. It's a sort of rite of passage for this creation coming to terms with the truth of its identity.
Yeah.
But it kind of gets lost because you're too busy watching all the dismemberment and gratuitous scenes of carnage, which are brilliantly drawn. And, you know, it would be nicer if the colours were more vivid because of that. Ultimately, it's unsatisfying because the story's a bit haphazard and sort of told at 120 miles an hour. But it's very typical of that sort of 1990s dark future dystopian type of comic book storytelling that we got around the time.
Okay.
And I guess in and at that time, I can see why it would win an Eisner Award, because it would be very different from the other stuff that was around. It's, you know, it predates Sin City, it predates Dark Knight. But so I can see how it stood out. Now it feels a little bit, because other people have taken that baton, picked it up and run further with it.
Like Frank Miller has taken that baton and run further with it.
And then beaten several execs with it, I would imagine. But yeah, in a way, I'm kind of glad that it's Jeff Darrow that's done the art rather than Frank Miller, because I have found recently that Frank Miller's art, and don't tell him I said this, isn't actually very good.
Shock!
And when I say that, I'm talking about things like the later Dark Knight stuff.
I have to ask, does he do that upside down jumping pose in this?
Possibly, but that might just be one of the corpses being hurled through the air.
True.
In this context, there are a lot of scenes of hero, anti-hero, whatever you want to call it, being shot so close to death that it's amazing someone doesn't pick him up and start using him as a colander. But there's this female version of the robot personality that turns up to start telling him what his true nature is. And she just seems to turn up out of nowhere. It's not like it's part of a cunningly constructed plot. She just turns up in the middle of this chase scene and starts knocking seven bells out of Carl stroke, Nixon stroke, Unit 4. And there's a whole thing about the rise of the machines. Are we enslaving conscious beings and stuff like that? But all the message kind of gets lost in this orgy of violence.
I was going to say, I thought we were talking about Hard-Boiled, and where did we go to Terminator?
Well, exactly. And that's it. It's all those sci-fi tropes around, you know, cyborgs and consciousness and slavery and all the rest of it. They're all mashed up somewhere on a background level. But the foreground level is all about the violence.
Okay.
It's been a disappointing week.
It has.
Weirdly enough...
Comics, you must try harder.
Yeah. Weirdly enough, Andrew's manga, Flying Witch, seems to be the high point this week.
It does.
Yeah, well done, Flying Witch.
Yeah.
Yeah, well done you.
It soars above the competition.
And on that bombshell...
I feel dirty. That's the one joke where I feel bad for making it. Let's just go.
Yes. As you've heard, we're at the end of the show. All our shows are available on Audioboom and iTunes. And if you are a regular listener, then subscribe to the Geek Show Podcast Network, which we are part of. We also have a Patreon. So if you are regular and you like listening to us regular, then support us on Patreon. You'll find the link on our website. Or go to Patreon and Google The Geek Show, and you'll see our familiar top hat bespectacled man looking smug within his carton of milk. So, yeah, we'll be back next week with more comics, graphic novels, that sort of thing. Until then, I have been Rob.
I've been Andrew.
And I've been seriously scarred by reading Hard-Boiled.
We'll see
and
you.
Also Mick.
All right. We'll see you all later.
Thanks for listening.